You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger, and I'm your host, and I'm so glad you're able to join us today. And my guest this week, we have Rod Bennett, and Rod is the author of the latest book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church. And what a book this is. It comes from Catholic Answers, and what it does is it talks about a theory, a very popular theory, that there is this great apostasy in the church with the early Christians, that Emperor Constantine took a pinch of this, a little bit of that, and boom, he created his own version of Christianity, which turned into the horrible thing of Catholicism that many Protestants hang their hat on this apostasy to show that Catholicism is wrong, that the Catholic Church is wrong. So Rod will be here to talk about that. Rod sits himself in nicely with my top three of the Church Fathers conversations. I like talking about the Church Fathers, and when it comes to Church Fathers, to me, is Mike Aquilina, Jimmy Akin, and Rod Bennett. So this is going to be an interesting conversation coming up. But before we get into that, I want to share a little story with you and share some thoughts with you on that story. And this story is about a boy who went by the name Sparky. Okay? So Sparky was not very good in school. He failed every subject in the eighth grade. He flunked physics in high school. He received a flat zero in the course. Zero. Which made him the worst physics student in the school's history. Sparky flunked Latin, algebra, English, and he didn't do much better in sports either. So frankly, in the way schooling was, Sparky would have been considered an absolute failure. He did manage to make the school's golf team, but he lost the most important match of the season. It was a consolation match he was in as well, and he lost that too. So throughout his youth, Sparky was, I think we can say, awkwardly, socially, he was awkward. He wasn't accepted because of his failures. People disliked, he wasn't really disliked, but no one really associated with him too much. He was astonished if a classmate ever said hello to him outside of school hours. There's no way to tell how he might have done it dating, because no one ever talked to him. Sparky never once asked a girl to go out in high school, and he was too afraid that he'd be turned down because of his unpopularity. He is what many people would call a loser, unfortunately. And everyone knew it. Even Sparky knew it. But he played along. He made up his mind early on that if things were meant to work out, they would. Otherwise, he would content himself with what appeared to be his inevitable lot in life, shall we say. Sparky was a loser again. It just was what it was. However, one thing was important to Sparky. He loved to draw. He is proud of his artwork. Of course, no one else appreciated it because, well, Sparky was looked down on. In his senior year of high school, he submitted some cartoons to the editors of the yearbook, hoping that they would, by some small shred, glimmer of hope that he would be accepted for something in his senior year. Now he was turned down. It was painful for Spark to be turned down because he thought his artwork was really good. But he accepted it, and he moved on with that rejection. But he was so convinced that he was a good artist that he decided to take his love, his hobby, and make it his craft and become a professional artist. As soon as he graduated from high school, Sparky wrote a letter to Walt Disney Studios. They told him to send in some samples of his artwork, which he did, and they gave him a subject matter for a cartoon to draw. Sparky drew it. He spent a great deal of time on that drawing, and on all the other drawings he submitted to Disney. Finally, he got a reply back from Disney Studios. He was rejected again. So Sparky graduates high school, enters adult life, and he's still rejected. So he decided to write about his life in cartoons. His cartoons have become his autobiography. He described his childhood self, the little loser boy, the chronic underachiever, the one who was looked down upon, the one that people didn't think they could rely on in school to do anything of any substantial significance. His cartoon character became famous worldwide. For Sparky, this boy who failed every subject in the eighth grade, the boy who got a zero in physics, the boy who was the worst physics student in his school's history, the boy who flunked Latin, algebra, and English, the boy that was rejected time and time again, finally saw success. And that success would stick with Sparky until the day he passed away. So who is Sparky, you might be asking? Sparky is none other than Peanuts comic strip creator Charles Schulz. He created the Peanuts comic strip and the little cartoon boy whose kite would never fly, and who never succeeded in kicking the football, who Lucy always pulled the football away from. Charles Schulz was Charlie Brown. Now, I bring that story up for a couple reasons today. We all have failures. We all have points in our life where we try to go grab the gold and we just can't get it. It's out of our reach. It seems like nothing we do allows us to attain the prize that we want in life. And that can happen in multiple things. For Charles Schulz, it was school. Didn't do good in sports, didn't do good in class, didn't have many friends. He could have checked out of life into a lifetime of rejection and just not achieved anything. He could have just sat back, not tried, gave up on himself, but he didn't. He continued to try throughout his life, his early life, until finally, I mean, let's face it, he was rejected by Walt Disney Studios. At that time, the biggest cartoon or animation house in the world. He was flat out rejected. Did he quit? Nope. He made his own comic strip. And he used his life of rejection to serve as lessons for us. So I think that's an important story for us all to consider, to think about, to ponder. You know, even when life gives us lemons, we gotta find sugar, grapes, something tasty, something sweet out of every situation. These tests are given to us to build our character. You know, Charles Schulz wasn't a good student. He wasn't. But he was good as an artist. And he knew deep inside that he was good as an artist. And he applied himself and he made it happen. We can overcome anything. We can overcome anything. As long as we have God on our side and Jesus, anything is possible. So how do we get that? How do we make sure that we have God and Jesus on our team? Well, the first step is a prayer life. Having a one-on-one relationship with Jesus through prayer is invaluable. We can tackle the biggest linebacker there is. We can climb the highest mountain. We can do whatever it is we want. As long as we have faith, we can attain it. We can attain it. Charles Schulz gives us that lesson today. And there are many other stories of other people that overcame obstacles to succeed. But what's really cool about Charles Schulz is he succeeded by telling people about his failures. He wasn't, that's the other thing with the Peanuts comic strip. You know, Charles Schulz was not afraid to put himself out there. Charlie Brown is Charles Schulz. And if you look at Charlie Brown, he had a lot of failures in his life as well. But what he did have was faith, and he had his pal Snoopy. And you know, every one of us, I think, at some point has a pal Snoopy. It may not be a dog, it may be a human being, it may be a cat. But Charlie Brown, at the end of every comic strip run or every animated TV show that he was in, he found the shimmer of gold in that impossible task he was doing. And we have to be the same way as well. People face problems. We know that. We all do. I think I said that earlier. But we can overcome those problems. We can be successful at anything we put our minds to. Don't let yourselves become trapped in your failures. Don't dwell on them. So you failed. Move on. Go to the next thing. See what life brings you. I think that's the important thing about that story about Charles Schulz, the boy known as Sparky, who was a failure and grew up to be one of the most famous comic strip writers of our time. I'll leave you with that thought. And when we come back, we'll have Rod Bennett, and we're going to talk a little bit about the early Christian church, how the Catholic Church was started, and his book, The Apostasy That Was. You're listening to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox, your host, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and today my guest is Rod Bennett. Rod is the author of Four Witnesses, The Early Church in Her Own Words, which is a bestseller from Ignatius Press. But today we're here to talk about his new book from Catholic Answers, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church, a fantastic book on the early church. Welcome, Rod Bennett.
Hello, Pete. Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. And so let's dive right in, shall we? Your book's called The Apostasy That Wasn't, and it's about the Great Apostasy. So for those unfamiliar, what exactly is the Great Apostasy?
Well, the Great Apostasy is a theory that's held by many non-Catholic Christians, that the original church founded by Jesus and the apostles eventually went off the rails, that it was the original church lost its purity in the hands of sinful men through the years, and that at some point that church had decayed or been corrupted so badly that the Holy Spirit either abandoned it or you know, there are various different versions of the story, but the idea is that the original church was lost and it had to be refounded again at some point, or rediscovered, or however you might want to say it, by some latter-day prophet or reformer.
Right, and from the back cover of the book, you know, it tells us part of it is that a lot of Protestantism, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, and even Islam hang their hats on the Great Apostasy to justify their own religious beliefs.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you look back at history and you see that the Catholic Church was large and in charge for 1,000 years, you know, you identify your own group's teachings with those of the early church, and you think that the teachings of your pastors and leaders now is right. So the whole idea implies that something happened, some sort of catastrophe happened, and a false version of Christianity took over for a while. So just inherent in the idea that the Catholic Church is wrong is some form of a great apostasy idea, although not everybody would use that terminology.
Right. Now, there's also a theory that, you know, we know that Emperor Constantine, during the Roman Empire, opened up the open up and freed the people to do their worshiping of Christianity. And there's a theory that Constantine and I'm going to use a visual here, was sort of a mad scientist that went into his lab, mixed a pinch of this, a cup of that, stirred everything together, and voila, he created his own version of Christianity that that eventually became Roman Catholicism.
Right, that's a pretty common idea.
So how did people even come up with that theory? It's so, to us as Catholics, to me, that is just such a far-fetched idea that I, you know, how did people even come up with that?
Well, essentially, since this is a historical theory, in other words, this is an idea about history that people have come up with. So you've got to find a starting point for it, and you've got to find some sort of initiating event, some sort of watershed that caused such a profound thing to happen. I mean, like I say, the whole idea that the original church that Christ founded, lost the truth, fumbled away the message, is a pretty radical idea. And so if you go looking around in history for some starting point where this happened, you're going to be attracted to watershed moments. And it's absolutely true that the founding of Christianity in the Roman Empire, the legalization that happened under the Emperor Constantine and the subsequent adoption of the Roman Empire of the Christian faith, I mean, it is an enormous watershed. There's no question. The question is what meaning we're going to put on that watershed. Was it a success or was it a catastrophe? Well, you're going to interpret that depending on how you feel about Catholicism, because there's absolutely no question at all that that date, that period is associated with the uniting of Roman ways with Christian ways, as we see in the history of the Catholic Church.
Indeed. Now, one thing I want to do here is I want to sidestep away from the book a little bit, because I think this plays an important role in your writing of the book and the book itself, the story it's telling. So you were a convert, a former Southern Baptist, and you believed in the great apostasy. I mean, that was one of the things you were taught as a Baptist. And I've read, leading up to this interview with you, that reading the Church Fathers is one of the things that led you to the Catholic Church. So can you tell us a bit about your own conversion story?
Yeah, I think I can do that. That's in some ways it was a long process. In other ways, it's pretty simple. And it is rooted in history. I've always been a bit of a history buff, and I think the examination of history, the looking back into it and trying to find, understand history in terms of my faith, is essentially what led me to my decision. I wouldn't necessarily say that as a Southern Baptist we used the terminology the Great Apostasy, but we did have the idea that that some less radical form of it happened. In other words, we didn't necessarily hold that the Holy Spirit had abandoned the church for 1,000 years or whatever. We would have said that there was some sort of remnant hiding out in secret on the outs with the Catholic authorities, and that we were the descendants of that remnant. But of course, that's a historical idea. In other words, that's an historical thesis. So it can be tested historically. You're not just free to spin conspiracy theories, at least not for somebody who takes history seriously. If you put forward something like that, then your young men will likely go forth and find out whether that's really true or not. And I was one of those young men. So the study of history, well, one of the things that alarmed me in looking at my own evangelical Christian faith was the fact that we had this gigantic gap on our timeline as Christians. In other words, yes, the period of Christ and the apostles, the early church, we might have gone just a little past the New Testament into the stories of the catacombs and Christians being fed to the lions and all the rest of it. But after that, if you follow the evangelical Christian timeline, you go 1,500 years or so to the time of Martin Luther before you find many people that our leaders were willing to put forward to us as heroes of the faith or as good role models. And that's a giant, for somebody who's got a sense of history, you've just proposed a 1,500-year gap in our history as Christians. You've given us an enormous red flag for saying something's fishy about this story. And so when you started to think about it, it was a strange idea. You and it does imply a great apostasy, even though they might not have wanted to use those exact words. So going back, well, the key event in my own conversion are the things that are talked about in the first book you mentioned, my book Four Witnesses, which is really essentially my conversion story, because my conversion happened largely from discovering the earliest church fathers, what are known as the apostolic fathers, the Christian leaders who took over immediately after the original apostles in the first and second centuries AD. As evangelical Christians, you're not, or didn't used to be anyway, your attention wasn't directed very often to the idea that large amounts of written material from that era survives. It's not just a blank spot on the map that we can project our own, you know, it's not an ink blot test that we can project our own ideas on. There really is records of the church during that period. And discovering that those records existed and that I could read them if I wanted to, and that they weren't all that difficult to understand, was an enormous shock to the system. Especially when I started reading those early writers, people like Ignatius of Antioch, who lived just a few years after the Apostle John, Clement of Rome, who we think was baptized by Peter, is mentioned in the Bible, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus of Lyon, early writers who left us hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation about what they believed in and what the church was like during their lives. And discovering that material, and even worse, discovering that it all sounded a whole lot more Catholic than it did Southern Baptist, just about did the deal, I'm afraid. That just about finished me off.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to ignore that large amount of writings that are out there. I myself am a convert from UCC, United Church of Christ, although as a youth we didn't go very often, but that's what I was confirmed in that faith, and then I had to pleasure of meeting my wife, who was a practicing Catholic, cradle Catholic, and was introduced to the church through her. I didn't immediately discover the writings of the fathers until later in my Catholic faith, because, you know, in the beginning, it was very exciting, you know, when you first convert and everything. And then I kind of went through a dry spell, and the church fathers and the writings of them are actually what pulled me out of that and then brought me to where I am today. So it's very hard to ignore, the writings of the church fathers. Everybody wants to base everything on the Bible, but there's a huge amount of other sources out there.
In case we have any evangelical listeners right now, I'd like to hesitate on that point just a moment. We don't approach the writings of the church fathers as scripture. It's not a Third Testament for Catholics. They're witnesses. That's the reason I chose the title Four Witnesses for my book. In other words, we look to them as people who can, by their writings, just give us a sense of what the church was like in those early centuries. And we're not treating it as the word of God, but we are treating it as the word of eyewitnesses. In other words, they're telling us what things were like, what sort of beliefs passed for orthodoxy in those days. And by their consensus, by so many of them agreeing on so much, a sense of which opinions were mainstream at that time. And that those facts are very important, a very important help for giving us a sense historically of whether our particular denomination's blend of doctrines makes sense historically.
Exactly. So we're going to take a brief break here, Rod, and we'll be right back. We'll pick up with that. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here exclusively on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and we're here today with Rod Bennett, and we're talking about his newest book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church. Last segment, we wrapped up talking about the church fathers and the significance of their writings. And to to segue off of that a little bit, you know, I've had conversations with non-Catholics where they want to actually take the writings of the Church Fathers and interpret them in a manner that's totally different than what they meant. One example I have is Ignatius of Antioch in his writings, where he was justifying the existence of bishops in the hierarchy of the church. And it was a Baptist I was speaking with at the time who totally turned that around and claimed that Ignatius was against the hierarchy of the church. So sometimes that gets a little difficult to deal with. Do you have any suggestions based on your own experiences of how we can deal with that as Catholics?
Well, the writings of the fathers are no more immune to multiple interpretations than the Bible itself is. And we do run up against the problem here of human nature. You know, the old proverb that says, the man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. That is something that's just a fact of our lives here on this fallen world. It would be difficult for me to believe that anybody who took what they were doing at all seriously could read the epistles of Ignatius of Antioch and come away with any idea other than the fact that he is hammering home as hard as he can the absolute duty of obedience to the bishops who succeeded the apostles. Every one of the seven authentic letters of Ignatius that we have is essentially a restatement of this same point to seven different churches, and he just hammers it home over and over again. No Christian worthy of the name will act apart from the bishop. No Eucharist is valid unless it's done in union with the bishop that succeeded the apostles. It's just that's a particularly grotesque plain example.
So yeah,
I think you may be dealing with somebody that's in denial.
Yeah,
and for that kind of person, I don't know what you can do. Prayer
right.
and fasting.
Right, there you go. So back to your book. You had your convert, you're writing about this myth of the apostasy, the great apostasy, and I've read that it took you some 10 years to complete this book. Is that true?
Well, it just, I don't know that I want that spread around. That's just a slow author, a dawdling, it took me 10 years to complete my conversion too. So, I will say that I worked on other things. I wrote several other books during the same 10 years.
I assume that as well.
Yeah, I think the 10 years was a 10-year thought process. And I had various parts of the book written during that period. But it only finally came together. The actual writing of the book, once I was ready to write it, only took about a year.
Gotcha. So how much research was involved in it? And what were some of your sources for research if after people read this book, which frankly I think is an excellent source on the topic after completing it myself.
Thank you for saying so. Well, that's mighty nice of you.
You're quite welcome.
I would say that there's difficulty in saying just how much of the research I did specifically for this book and how much of it is still more reading that I did in trying to figure the whole subject out on my own. I wasn't necessarily planning to write the book when I first read much of the source material that I based it on. But yes, most of it's the early fathers, but there are several other strong influences. Cardinal Newman, John Henry Newman, another convert from evangelical Anglicanism, he wrote a book called The Arians of the Fourth Century, which was one of a book that he wrote in the flush of enthusiasm when he was first discovering the early fathers. And it's a wonderful book, one of my favorites. And obviously the history of the Arian controversy figures very large in the story of Constantine and what happened during his reign. So that book undoubtedly was a huge influence in my writing what I did. So that might even be the number one influence. Also, I've even when I was an evangelical, I was an enormous admirer of G.K. Chesterton, and a lot of Chesterton and also his friend Hilaire Belloc, a lot of their thought paved the way for this book, opening my mind to the subject at hand. So those would be some examples.
there's one thing that struck me in the very early part of the book, and that was a reference to the church as quote unquote a ghetto church.
Right. Yeah, in the sense of the ghettos of Jewish ghettos right. in Eastern Europe prior to World War II, not the kind that made it into 70s black action movies.
Correct. But can you explain a little bit about a little more detail what your thought process was behind that?
Well, yeah, in reading about how Jews lived as a minority in Europe during the period, say, from the Middle Ages up until the Second World War. They, even before they were forcibly herded into ghettos by the Nazis, they tended to live close to their places of worship. Orthodox, that's very important to this day for Orthodox Jewry, since they have to walk. But also, you know, they were looked on as a bit of an alien minority, and they kept to themselves in the sense that they had their own neighborhoods and their own type of food and all the rest of it. And this is, I think, I use it as an example of how the Christian church related to the Roman Empire for the 150 years or so immediately prior to Constantine legalizing the faith. One of the things that throws people off about the history of the early church is that you see stories of the very early days, you know, persecution under Nero and things like that. And many people have the impression that before Christianity was legal, that that whole 300-year period before it was legal was like this, Christians huddling in the catacombs and other things like that. The image is out of Bible movies from the 50s and 60s largely. But the reality is that Christianity grew and grew and grew, and by the year, even in Tertullian's time, he's talking about how we're so numerous now, 200 AD, that we could take over the empire if that was our will. And so the degree to which Christianity came out of the catacombs and became a huge, huge minority, still a minority, but a huge culture, perhaps as much as a fifth of all all the citizens of the Roman Empire by 200 or so, is an unappreciated fact by a lot of people. And Christianity in the third century AD, that is the years, the 200s, was ubiquitous. It was known by everybody. Even though it was technically illegal still, the laws against it were still on the books. Nevertheless, Christians served in the army openly. Christian churches were built openly. It's one of the early Christian writers, Lactantius, tells us that there was a large Christian basilica directly across the street from the emperor's house in his day. We're talking about 250 AD. So all of this paints a very different picture than many believers in the great apostasy myth would have you believe. A lot of the great apostasy myth is framed in terms of there was this innocent, pure, persecuted early church with no political power, and that it kept a kind of an innocence, a kind of an unfallen quality. And then when horrible old Constantine came along and got it all mixed up with power and politics, then we lost that innocence, and Catholicism was the result. In reality, I mean, even Eusebius, the most commonly available church history there is, tells us that Christians were so important and powerful in the Roman Empire in the 200s AD that the emperors were actually jealous of many Christian leaders for having more influence and wealth than they did. So it's a much more interesting, much more complex story than I appreciated before I started researching it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand the rate at which conversions were happening in the Roman Empire. And it wasn't necessarily because Constantine released the reins a little bit. It was because Romans were witnessing how good Christians had it. Christian wives were treated well. The children right. obeyed their parents. The family unit was strong. And Romans were like, hey, we want some of that. And the only way they were going to get it was to convert.
Well, yeah, perhaps the single most important fact, and this is something that has been greatly, we've been helped a lot by secular research in recent years into the period we're talking about. And that is the fact, the degree to which Constantine's conversion and his sponsoring of Christianity was really a reaction to, rather than the cause of, the success of Christianity in the Roman Empire. It was by far, Christianity was a large, thriving movement at a time when the empire itself was in decay. And most everybody that looked at what was happening could easily see that it was much the liveliest and healthiest thing left in the Roman Empire at that point, and that the degree to which people started, including Constantine, got on the bandwagon is something that's not appreciated enough. So even most basic idea of the great apostasy myth, that Constantine became Christian, the first Christian emperor, but gradually began sponsoring his own favorite version of Christianity and suppressing everything else. Constantine wasn't really the cause of much of anything. He responded to conditions in the empire in his day more than being the instigator of them.
So with that, we're going to take another break. You're listening to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox here with Rod Bennett, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. My guest today has been Rod Bennett. We've been talking about the early church and his book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Extraordinary Story of the Unbreakable Early Church. And Rod, your book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, deals with a moment in time where the church is really getting its legs underneath, it's getting its footing, it's growing in leaps and bounds, and things are starting to look pretty good for the future of the entity that Christ had established. I think we can't deny that in the 2000 history of the church, it's definitely had its ups and downs. But in our own day, in our own time, as you and I sit here and talk right now, it feels like society is doing a really good job of marginalizing the church. Relativism is creeping into our society. It has a strong grip on our youth. It's led them to believe in a theory that it's all about me, me, me. As long as I'm happy, it doesn't matter about what anybody else has to say about what I'm doing. So how can we use the early church as an example to pull us out of this?
Now is sort of the mirror image of, as we mentioned earlier, the interest of the church and the interest of secular society became the same for a while. But I think at least since the time of the French Revolution and probably earlier, since that time, the dog has sort of been going back to its own vomit. We've come out the other end of the era of Christendom, and gradually Western society, the old pagan Roman Empire, is trying to basically get a divorce and to decide that we don't need the relationship to the church anymore. And Christian ideas and influence have been steadily rejected since that time. In some ways, of course, that's terrible. But in other ways, it puts us more in touch with this period of the early church we've been talking about, the 300-year period during the courtship before the marriage. So in some ways, we're back. We're put in a close rapport with our brethren in the early church, which is why it's such a good example to us. It's how they lived and how they related to a secular authority that was indifferent or hostile to their ideas is a good example for how we can go about and should go about it today. And so it sets a good model for us. We've got already pre-existing role models for how to do this. And the mental process that's required for Christians to realize that the divorce has either happened or is almost final is probably going to be good for the church. To realize that we can't depend on the secular arm anymore to teach our ideas in schools, to do our charity for us via taxes and all the rest of it. In other words, these are evangelization, charitable works, all of these things are things that are our responsibility, not Caesar's, and that to the degree that he was willing to pitch in for a while, that's great. But now, you know, we're going to have to wean ourselves off of that, I think, and start being the church again and not looking to accomplish these Christian goals with Caesar's gold and armies, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. Very good point. Very good point. Now, we talked about your conversion. We talked a little bit about mine. Obviously, you have a great interest in the church fathers, and I've asked some other guests I've had on the show this question as well, in particular, my good friend Mike Aquilina and Jimmy Akin as well. So you have an interest in the church fathers. Who's your favorite church father?
Oh, goodness. Oh, well, right now I'm deeply enmeshed in writing another book that involves where Justin Martyr is the main character. And so it's hard to tell whether this is just the mood I'm in or what, but I like Justin. And he figures very prominently in Four Witnesses, and now I find myself writing another book that's mainly about him also in a partnership with Dr. Scott Hahn. So he and I have got a subject in mind that's best told through the eyes of Justin Martyr. So he's big on my list at the moment.
Great. Now, the particular book we're talking about today, The Apostasy That Wasn't, you deal a lot with the church figure Athanasius. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Athanasius is also another great candidate. If you'd got me a couple of 6 months earlier, I might have said Athanasius. Athanasius, I've told other people, is sort of the Frodo Baggins of church history. Diminutive little guy, hobbitish fellow. The people call him a dwarf, in fact, and he may well have been dwarfish. He's a very humble little person, and yet in some ways is almost a second founder of the Christian faith, because he certainly saved Christianity in the period of the era of Constantine that book is focused on. More than any other person, single-handedly, he brought the church across a period of great attack. You know, in spite of the fact that my whole book is meant to debunk the great apostasy theory, the idea that something went fundamentally awry in the time of Constantine, there really was an unprecedented attack on the church during that period and an attempt to paganize it. So the idea is not entirely groundless. It's just that the people who usually say this have picked all the wrong villains. It's not Constantine and the Catholic Church that were trying to paganize Christianity. They were the ones that saved it to a large degree. And but you'll have to read the book for the rest of that story. But Athanasius is certainly a heroic little character. Heroes come in all sizes.
Yes, they do. Indeed, they do. Which the Lord of the Rings taught us that.
Right.
So you talked a little bit about a project you're working on now. Is there any other projects you have going on? Any other books? You're obviously, I really enjoyed this book. I've browsed through the Four Witnesses, and now you got my interest peaked to go back and do a reread of that. So what else does Rod Bennett have on his plate right now?
Well, for those who want to look at some of the things that, excuse me. For those who might want to look at some of the things I've done in the past, you might look up my website. Just Google Rod Bennett author, and that'll take you right to my little author homepage, which has got too complicated an actual URL for me to try to give it out over the radio. But I've written a science fiction novel, which came out a few years ago, which I'm not really satisfied with, and am sort of in the middle of redoing also. So after the book about Justin comes out, I may try to take another crack at getting the science fiction novel, which is called The Christus Experiment. Try to get it published, much improved second edition published. And let's see, there's wow, several other things. I've got a book about John Wesley that's been percolating in my mind for a long time. One of the problems with this kind of writing is that it's hard to get evangelicals to read Catholic books.
I can't imagine why.
Most of my books are aimed at trying to talk to my old brethren, for whom I still cherish a great affection, and would like to say, as St. Paul did, that I would that I myself might even be lost in order to win them over. I mean, that's one of the motivating things in my life, is to try to explain all the misunderstandings that my old friends who can't understand what I've done, so that they'll understand it again and we can be friends. So, it's awfully hard to persuade. In other words, if you write a book that's meant to persuade evangelicals, the trouble is getting the evangelicals to read it. So if it comes with the Catholic name on it anywhere on the cover, it's a pretty hard sell. I think most of my books up to now, the Catholic-oriented books, have been purchased by Catholics, but I do think that quite a few of them have made their way into the hands of evangelicals, just, or at the very least, fallen away Catholics, people's friends and relatives that used to be in the church and have gone elsewhere. I think a lot of, I still get to talk to a lot of those people. So who knows, the Wesley book might get written one day, but if I can't figure out a way to get it into the hands of evangelicals, I'm not sure that Catholics will buy a book about John Wesley. So.
Maybe you'll be the bridge.
I found the conundrum.
One last quick question, because you raised something there that I think is interesting. You have a fiction book, science fiction book. How difficult is it for you to switch from something like, you know, the apostasy? It wasn't a hard fact driven book that's nonfiction, to writing fiction as an author.
Not difficult for me at all. In fact, most of the people who have read the my church history books, the books about the fathers and stuff, have commented many times that it reads like a novel. And in fact, I use kind of novelistic devices in writing these books. You know, they don't claim to be scholarship, even though the facts are as close to correct as I can get them. They're told in a colloquial way that includes some storytelling that reads an awful lot like a novel. In fact, I wrote the novel because I was encouraged to. A lot of the people who read Four Witnesses said, wow, you should be a novelist. So I used that as an excuse to try to write one. So that's how it came about. And no, I've always been a fan of, science fiction, fantasy. We talked about Lord of the Rings a few minutes ago. So that sort of thing has always been interesting to me. So no, it was no switch at all.
Well, great. Rod, thank you so much for spending some time with us here today and talking about your latest book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, and people can find that at Catholic Answers Press. Any closing comments?
Well, just thank you for having me on the show today. It's been fun.
You're quite welcome. And with that, we've come to the end of our show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. You've been listening to Breadbox Media. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.